agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is political and policy analyst Kristen Matheny. Hey, Kristen.
Mike, how are you?
I am, well, kind of exhausted by this crazy week, as I imagine you are, too.
Yes, just a tad.
Yeah, it's been something keeping up. But before we get to that, I wanted to thank some new supporters of the show. There's Joel, who recently increased his Patreon pledge to the show. Thank you, Joel. We appreciate that. Jessica, a new supporter on Patreon. And Kevin, also a new supporter from the San Francisco Bay Area, who wrote in, "I've been listening for a couple of years now and routinely share episodes with friends and family. I love everything the Politics Guys does and the critical thinking behind the discussions and comments on the podcast." Thank you, Kevin. We try for the critical thinking and we appreciate that you appreciate it. And then finally, Mike, who I mentioned on last week's show, but I didn't get a chance to read the great message he says, and so I'd like to share that with everyone. Mike writes, "Thank you so much for putting this show on. I've been religiously listening over the last year or so and have gotten to the point where my Saturday runs are timed out so that I can listen to a new episode." Yeah, I Trey will especially like that because Trey's the runner in our group there. Anyway, he writes, "I'm excited now to be able to listen to the bonus show. And I wanted to let you know that I'm someone who voted for Trump, but based on the last 2 years, I'm embarrassed by that. That being said, this extreme left shift I'm seeing in the Democratic Party makes me very nervous that I will be forced to vote for Trump again. Again, love the show. Keep up the great work. I really believe in what you're doing." And I thought that message from Mike was especially appropriate, Kristen, because that's going to tie into some stuff that I think we'll get to this week. And actually a question or two that I have for you and Jay and, you know, in future weeks, some of our conservative hosts about that kind of leftward shift and voting for Trump and red lines and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, thanks, everyone. If you want to become a supporter and get access to the bonus show and our quick take and all that stuff, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can just go to politicsguys.com/support. We really do appreciate it. Okay, to the business at hand. Well, you know, we got subpoenas flying. We've got congressional investigations. We got President Trump calling accusers close to spies and suggesting that, well, you know, maybe the chair of the House Intelligence Committee should be arrested for treason. Word of a potential second whistleblower who has more direct knowledge of the White House's dealings with Ukraine than the initial whistleblower. It's been crazy trying to keep track of everything. So what I thought maybe we could do, Kristen, is to kind of take some time to separate what we actually know from what we think we know and what we might believe could be possible and what we feel and all that kind of stuff.
It's pretty hard with this whole Ukraine scenario to separate those two, because I found myself doing the same thing. I made a list of facts, just like you did, things that we know. And it, every time I listed a fact and I would do a little bit of research, or I would think about what I saw on the news, you know, on whatever channel it was, I would start to drift into that conjecture territory. Yeah. And I don't know that it's entirely possible to separate the two, but we will try.
That's exactly what I did. And I thought, you know, I tried really hard to focus on just the clear facts, and I tried to put them in some sort of a coherent order. And so I thought just for me, that helped me out considerably in trying to wrap my head around this. And I thought, well, you know, this might actually be pretty helpful for listeners too, who are just being bombarded by all of these stories, to kind of pull back and you know, be able to see the forest for the trees.
I agree.
Okay, so here we go. Here are the facts as I understand them in what I think is the most coherent order. Number one, we know that President Trump asked Ukraine's president for several favors, including that Ukraine investigate Hunter and Joe Biden. That's been pretty clearly established because we have the White House acknowledging that, yes, this in the transcript, basically, or the record, whatever, not exactly the transcript, but the summary of the transcript. Secondly, we know that national security officials assigned a special clearance to the conversation, the transcript of it, one that hadn't previously been used for conversations of a similar nature. Now, as to why that's the case, that gets into speculation, but we do know that it was given special status, right? We know that prior to that call, President Trump ordered that $400 million, or right around $400 million, in military aid to Ukraine that was authorized by Congress, that would be withheld due to what the administration says are corruption concerns. We also know that President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who's a private citizen, not part of government, has for quite a while been actively pressuring Ukrainian officials to investigate the Bidens. We know that in the phone call with the Ukrainian president, President Trump specifically asks him to speak with Giuliani on the corruption investigation issue. We know that State Department officials in a text exchange, one of the officials, Bill Taylor, wrote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." But then, following a long pause in this text stream, another diplomat, Gordon Sondland, responded that President Trump has been crystal clear about no quid pro quos. We also know that Hunter Biden, who joined the board of Burisma, he joined it at a salary of $50,000 per month. He had almost no responsibilities, and this was at a time when his father was vice president. We know that Hunter Biden had no real background in energy, oil policy, and this was that. This seems at a time when his father was vice president. Seems a reasonable person would conclude that what Burisma was buying was access to the vice president. Now, this is something we don't know, but I think it strains credulity to the breaking point to argue that Hunter Biden was separate from his relationship to his father and the administration, somehow brought something to the table that wasn't that a whole bunch of other people wouldn't have brought to the table much more.
He was hardly an expert on Ukrainian business dealings and politics.
Exactly.
Right.
That being said, there's no evidence at all of either Hunter or Joe Biden doing anything corrupt or illegal. We also know that as vice president, Joe Biden actively pushed, as part of an international effort, to remove the prosecutor in Ukraine because he was refusing to investigate corruption in companies like Burisma. And this is the same prosecutor that Donald Trump on that phone call is on the record is calling very good and very fair, which, as far as I can tell, no one aside from President Trump seems to hold that same view. We also know that the Ukrainian president denies being pressured or coerced by anyone. I think he said, "The only one who pressures me is my 16-year-old son," basically. Yes. But
he is a comedian, after all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we would expect that, right? We also know that Ukraine's new chief prosecutor said on Friday that his office will conduct an audit of the investigation into Biden, although he also said that he's unaware of any wrongdoing on the part of either Joe or Hunter Biden. And finally, we know that so far there is no smoking gun or direct quid pro quo agreement offering aid in exchange for a corruption investigation. So I think that pretty much hits all of the main things that we know, as opposed to the things that we could speculate about. Does that seem about right? Does that track pretty well with your list?
Yeah, I think I have a list here going as well alongside my notes for the show, and you hit pretty much everything that I had written down, which I think speaks to the complexity of this issue and why I still haven't met anybody who is a Democrat or a Republican that's able to definitively say, yes, this happened, or no, this didn't happen, because this is so muddied and so muddled. You know, so I do think you hit all of the points, and I have to commend you because you were pretty unbiased when you did it. So
Well, I did my best, like I said, to try to separate the things I wanted to believe from the things that I think I believe and the things that I know. Now, there have been this week another kind of related thing, at least that people are kind of tying together, is the Attorney General Barr, who has asked other countries for help in his investigation of the investigators. And that's that investigation that the Justice Department launched about whether or not elements of the intelligence community were engaged in some sort of an effort to hurt Donald Trump's election chances. Now, to me, that's a separate thing. I can get how people are kind of conflating these two things. But what makes it separate to me is that is a legitimate investigation that's going on through proper channels. Now,
Having said that,
I certainly believe that it's possible that Barr is being driven by partisan motives, and maybe the report that his investigator produces will be highly partisan, but I don't know that, and I want to wait till I see the report. And so, you know, there are some people on the left who are pointing out that the Attorney General is taking an unusual interest in this case, and I agree, but given the magnitude of the charges, it seems to me to be entirely appropriate for the Attorney General to take great interest because, hey, if the if there was actually the intelligence community acting in such a way to try to hurt or try to influence an election, that to me is that's pretty significant. And so that's why I say this really seems to me to be a separate sort of a thing, and I don't think we should conflate them.
I agree. I'm right there with you.
You know, then there's that thing where Donald Trump a few days ago publicly called on China to look into the Bidens as well. And I was wondering, so how do you see that kind of fitting into this context of the Ukraine thing?
Well, I mean, I think it falls kind of into a different category from what you mentioned just now with Attorney General Barr, because it's kind of dipping your toe into two different pools. I mean, obviously, you're talking about Joe Biden. Anytime that President Trump mentions Joe Biden, it's clearly politically motivated. So this is something that this would be something that is purely politically motivated. As for, you know, separating this from everything going on with the Ukraine, I think we kind of have to do that because they're two separate things. This is what the House Intelligence Committee is investigating. They're specifically investigating these claims regarding the Ukraine. So I don't know. I guess that's my take.
Well, you know what was interesting on that, what Ben Sasse had to say, the senator from Nebraska, he said, Americans don't look to Chinese commies for the truth. If the Biden kid broke laws by selling his name to Beijing, that's a matter for American courts, not communist tyrants running torture camps. Which, okay, number one, geez, he was clearly playing to the cheap seats out there. It's kind of a hyperbole laced sort of thing. But, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. I was wondering what you thought about Sasse's comments.
Ben Sasse is an interesting guy. I can't say that I blame him, but I think you could kind of say the same thing about things going on in the Ukraine, because this is not exactly a country that's been on the up and up in terms of being honest and open and free of corruption. So I think, and again, I don't want to get too far into the Ukraine issue, because I assume we're probably going to talk about that a lot more. But I think when it comes to China, I think Ben Sasse makes a point, but I think it was hyperbolic.
Yeah. I think a more sort of measured way of making that same point was what in Mitt Romney's statement, where if you haven't heard it, folks, it's he said, when the only American citizen President Trump singles out for China's investigation is his political opponent in the midst of the Democratic nomination process, it's strange credulity to suggest that it is anything other than politically motivated. By all appearances, the president's brazen and unprecedented appeal to China and to Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden is wrong and appalling. Now, that's a much stronger statement, and it kind of goes more directly at Donald Trump, and it fits in. I mean, I couldn't have said it better than Mitt Romney. So what was your reaction to Romney's statement there?
Well, Mitt Romney is a troublesome character because I think it's impossible to separate bias from all of this. You know, this idea that Democrats say that they're not acting with any sort of bias, Republicans saying they're not acting with any sort of bias, all political players act with a fair amount of bias, if not a strong amount of bias. And Mitt Romney's no exception. He doesn't like President Trump. He doesn't like him. He doesn't want to see him reelected. He's there to basically be a wall for President Trump. I believe that's why he ran for office again. And I think that when he talks about China, I think he makes, to be fair, I think he's saying something that's true. President Trump calling on China to investigate the Biden specifically is entirely politically motivated. I think it becomes problematic when you bring Ukraine into it, because I think you could argue something else as well. I think in Mitt Romney's case, I think part of what he's saying, there's some truth to it. I think part of what he's saying is conjecture on his part, because we really haven't determined what the motivation, whether there was something quid pro quo going on with the Ukraine between President Trump and the Ukraine. I mean, there are a lot of questions involved there. So, you know, I'll give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt with China. The rest of it, I don't know. He might have just been lumping those two together, which I think is problematic.
Well, one that to me, one of the most troublesome aspects is the fact that a lot of this seems to have been spearheaded by the president's personal attorney. And it's one thing, it seems to me, to launch a official investigation with you know, duly either elected or appointed members of the United States government to look into corruption. But it's something else entirely when your personal attorney is meeting with high-level officials, and when, in fact, the president of the United States says to the president of another country, hey, my personal attorney, Rudy, he's going to be coming over and help him out with this thing. I don't see how that is, even if, and you know, I've said this before, even if Hunter Biden is guilty of all kinds of corruption and we have no evidence of that whatsoever, how that is remotely ethical, how that is not just completely corrupt involving your encouraging heads of state to work with your personal attorney on an investigation of your political opponent and pretty clearly linking it to U.S. assistance. I don't understand any world in which that does not just seem completely and utterly corrupt. Maybe you can help me out on this.
I probably can't help you on this because I said I would agree with you to some extent. I said last week we did a bonus show episode with I think it was me, you, and Jay, and we were talking a lot about Rudy Giuliani. And what I said when we were doing this bonus show was I said that I think he's not only do I think it's inappropriate to put him in this position to sort of elevate his position to something more than what it is, other than being a personal attorney for the president. But I also think, as much as I have a lot of respect for Giuliani, and I've said this in the past, I have a lot of respect for him for what he did in New York. I think he did a wonderful job as mayor. I have respect for him as a person. I think he's a terrible mouthpiece for this because, I mentioned this last week, he was all over the pundit shows. I won't say news shows because they are pundit shows on Fox News. And I watched him on Laura Ingraham, which I think was his first appearance, because I was curious to see what would he address this in some substantive way? You know, would he talk about it? And he didn't. I think that Rudy Giuliani is probably not an appropriate mouthpiece for any of this. And I think he's not a great mouthpiece either. Yeah. And so, you know, I can't really shed too much light on it other than the fact that, you know, again, this isn't anything you don't know. The president, Donald Trump, values loyalty above, it seems like, almost everything else sometimes. And he takes these personal relationships very seriously. He's had a personal relationship with Rudy Giuliani that spans decades, decades, you know, just because of their New York connections and their business connections. And, you know, he tends to keep that very, very close. Even as president, he's kept that close. And I'm not surprised that he gave Rudy Giuliani this position. Do I think he's the best mouthpiece or even an appropriate mouthpiece? No.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
You know, it seems to me that Donald Trump, his MO on this is basically to not make, and I don't even know if he understands the distinction between himself and the state. You know, there's that old Louis XIV quote, I am the state. And I think Donald Trump in some way might actually not think he's doing anything wrong. In his brain, I could totally envision him thinking, well, I was elected president, and that means I can do whatever I want, essentially, to stay in office, to win re-election, to destroy my opponents. And any person who helps me is helping the country by definition. And anyone who says anything against me is almost a spy or treasonous, as you know. And I'm sure you found that his calls on Twitter for, you know, arresting Adam Schiff for treason, or saying that the whistleblower, the so-called whistleblower, which is the GOP talking point on that, it seems to me, is the ad, the so-called, is almost a spy. And you know what we used to do to spies? I'm sure you find that just reprehensible, right?
I think that I've made no secret on the show about how I think he goes way overboard on Twitter. I think he, you know, speaks like somebody who is a businessman. I do agree with you that he's still, you know, at his heart underneath the presidential, I guess the presidential cloak, he is still Donald Trump. And for all the things that, you know, that I do appreciate about him, that isn't one of them. And so you sort of, I guess you hit a sore spot for me, is his communication. And I voted for Donald Trump. I'll probably be voting for him again. But that is one thing that has always bothered me, is the messaging. But, you know, I think rather than talk about sort of these issues with Donald Trump messaging, because I agree with you, something that I don't think, and I really wanted to be sure to bring this up, something I don't think that Republicans are talking nearly enough about, and I think that we need to be sort of, I guess, reversing our talking point. We need to focus less on the whistleblower and more on the key question, which is whether the Trump administration was sort of conditioning this, like, better behavior and more aid to the Ukraine in an effort to get Biden specifically, or whether this was part of a larger corruption, sort of this culture of corruption, trying to do away with it. And I think that that's something, you know, I watched a ton of, I don't usually watch a lot of news. I watch it at night here and there. And I do flip around from channel to channel because I believe in making up my own mind. And, you know, that was something that I saw again and again and again from pundits, was just ignoring that main issue. And that really is the key issue. And it should be what the House Intelligence Committee, I guess it's not the Judiciary Committee, which is a whole other issue, but the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, this is what they should be focusing on, is this key question. And I think that that's why a lot of people in the know are so confused about this issue, because we do have this really long history predating President Trump, going back to the Obama administration. Joe Biden was one of the first people to step out of line and say, hey, you know, he bragged about withholding aid. Like you had mentioned this before, he bragged about withholding, I think it was like $1 billion in loan aid to the Ukraine over corruption. I mean, this is something that's not new. And so there's been this, I guess, this history of the U.S. accusing Ukraine of dealing with corrupt actors and, you know, having corrupt politicians. I know, like, back in 2018, you might have read this, and I had totally forgotten about this. There were three U.S. senators, all Democrats, who wrote to the Ukrainian government and told them that, basically in no uncertain terms, that they were going to withhold aid if they didn't cooperate in the Mueller probe. So this is not something that's new. I love this idea that people think this is like some new thing. This isn't. And I think that's the real question. It's so hard to tell, you know, is this something that's specifically pointed at Biden, sort of like his, you know, Donald Trump's comments about China? That was clearly all about Biden. He's just talking out of turn, which, again, you know, I have my feelings about that. But this is why the Ukraine question is so complex.
Yeah.
Well, I really wanted to be sure to add that, because it's been driving me nuts all week. We're not focused on that. And that's the question of this pre-inquiry.
I agree. I think the fundamental question is, well, on the one hand, if aid was being withheld because of concerns about corruption in general, and Donald Trump was simply using Joe Biden and Hunter Biden as what he felt to be the most prominent example of that. That's one thing. But if there was a concerted effort on the part of the administration to focus on Joe and Hunter Biden and use the general corruption thing as a cover, and that's the same thing with the CrowdStrike server and all that, that it was first political and then the corruption thing is just basically a fig leaf to put over it. Well, then that's beyond the pale.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that's what I mean, I want answers. I'm a Republican and I want answers. I would like to know, you know, just I said the same thing before the Mueller probe officially started and things really began sort of kicking off. I remember my Democratic friends saying to me, you know, like, you just want this Mueller probe to be over. And I was like, no, absolutely, I don't. I think it should go forward. I encourage it. I don't think he should fire Bob Mueller. I want to see this go on because I like the truth, just like you do. That's what we want. Like I said before, I think it's impossible to separate, you know, bias, things like bias and conjecture from fact. You know, was this politically motivated? Yeah, but everything is politically motivated. And so I think the question is, how politically motivated was it? You know, was the motivation to specifically target Hunter and Joe Biden, or was it kind of part of the picture? I mean, really, all of this hinges on the Bidens.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think your point about this, you know, whether or not Hunter Biden deserved this position is sort of not the point. I agree with you, but I think we need to figure out what the motivation was, and that hinges on the Bidens.
And you know, there's never going to be a smoking gun. Absent something like, for instance, Mike Pence just going totally rogue and saying, you know what, actually, yes, the president told me this. And, you know, or Rudy Giuliani losing what's left of his marbles. And I mean, none of that's going to happen. So I'm sure there never was clearly a quid pro quo sort of thing. I mean, but it's what you can infer from that. And I agree, you know, with Mitt Romney's interpretation of that. But you know, it occurred to me that this is becoming an easier and easier decision for me because I dislike Donald Trump immensely as a person. I feel just in his how he comports himself, I think he's done huge damage to the institution of the presidency and all that kind of stuff. But and also, I dislike almost all of his policies, his judicial appointments. And now there is what seems to me an increasing amount of evidence that he's committed what I believe to be an impeachable and removal worthy offense. But then I was thinking about you, Kristen. You know, you, of course, you don't really care for Trump as a person, but
no,
you like a lot of his policies, not all of them, but a lot of them. And you like a lot of his judicial appointments. And so I feel for me, Trump's crossed my red line, and I'm kind of with Elizabeth Warren here. I feel like, based on what I know, there would be enough for me to go ahead and vote to impeach and to convict and remove. But I was wondering, so what about you? You know, because there's obviously a balance kind of question here, you know, for a lot of conservatives, you know, where kind of the corruption and potential damage to the country and its institutions kind of outweighs the positives that a lot of people on the right see from the policies. And even more than that, the judicial appointments, as I pointed out in a show I did with Jay not too long ago, you know, Donald Trump has already appointed something like a quarter of all the appellate court judges. And that's huge. Right. And so how do you weigh that? I mean, is there a point at which you would say, you know, no matter how much good I think he's doing in judicial appointments and policies, this is just too much?
I think that I could reach a point if I didn't know, if I didn't feel in my heart, and again, here we go with the conjecture, but I can't separate it here. I feel in my heart that from the start, from before he even took office, I think Democrats have been looking to, I think they've sort of been throwing it all on the wall to see what sticks. And I think that I've seen this pattern, especially in the Democratic caucus, the shift to the left, this idea that they were going to impeach, you know, Tlaib said herself, you know, we'll impeach the MFR. And this has sort of been their rallying cry from the start. And I think they've been looking for a reason to do this. And again, again, you know, I go back to the idea that an impeachment doesn't mean he's going to be gone. And I think that's, I mentioned this in the bonus show last week, but that's something that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that it's such a process. I mean, feasibly, I, and again, conjecture, but I think that what Pelosi and a lot of Democrats are thinking is that they'll sort of tie this label of impeachment, or at least the term impeachment, to this president going into the 2020 election, which is why her comments about, you know, maybe they'll lose the House or maybe they'll lose the presidency sort of self-sacrifice, like, confused me, because I thought, well, then what are you doing this for? But I, you know, I think that this is a pattern. This is something that's been going on for a long time. I tried to remain very impartial during the Mueller investigation. I said from the start that I wanted to see what, you know, the Mueller investigation came up with. I didn't read the whole thing because it was very long, but I read most of it. I tried to get through it. I analyzed it as best I could from an unbiased perspective. I didn't see the connections that I think the Democrats were hoping to see. People like Adam Schiff really promised the world, and they said that they had these smoking guns and they had the evidence and they had the facts, and in the end it wasn't there. And I feel like this comes up again and again and again. And this is, the last couple of years has been all about trying to get Trump. And I'm sure we'll get into this later, but it's taking away from a lot of bigger issues that we could be tackling as a country. I mean, we've got a lot of things going on right now that really both sides could get behind. We've got this crisis at the border, immigration, which we've talked about at length on the show. You know, we've got issues regarding gun control and gun safety. And, you know, we've got a huge drug epidemic going on across this country from, you know, from coast to coast. And I think that all of this is taking away from that. And so I think I have a lot of Democratic friends who feel tired, kind of like the listener who wrote in. Was it Mike who wrote in and said, you know, there's a shift to the left and, you know, he's just not sure, he may be forced to vote for Trump again. I don't feel forced to vote for Trump again, but unless I see definitive, and again, like, it's not going to come out with this. We're not going to know for sure whether there's this smoking gun that links Trump to this quid pro quo scenario. But, you know, unless we see something that's definitive that to me changes my mind, and it could. I'm not somebody who's, you know, a diehard Trump fan, you know, bleeding red. I'm willing to listen to the facts, but unless I see it, and I haven't yet, I'm not willing to throw in the towel, because I think the threat of social, I mean, frankly, I think the threat of socialism, you know, and having somebody like Biden or Warren in office is just, I think it's too much for me to think about.
So basically, at this point, I mean, what to me seems like just an incontrovertibly clear case of the president abusing his power again. And to me, it's a pattern of things. And more people, you know, from the State Department are coming out, and the involvement of Rudy Giuliani. To me, this is there's no doubt. There's almost no doubt in my mind, 98, let's say, percent sure. But to you, there is a lot more doubt. And again, you know, something I always tell my students in class, you know, everyone's biased, and it's not a question of if they are. And so from my point of view, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that the president has not clearly abused his power to the extent that he needs to be removed from office at this point. But from your point of view, you're saying, nope, you need more.
Oh yeah, I need evidence. I do need proof of it. You know, this is, and you know, when you were talking just now, I tried to put myself in your shoes conversely, and I thought, you know, I remember during the Obama administration getting really upset, and I'm not somebody who really gets upset about politics per se, which is unusual. I think sometimes people say you need to be more passionate about these things, and I'm like, no, you know, I think about policy and stuff like that. And I remember getting really upset, and that surprised me during the Obama administration about some of the things that his, you know, officials were doing as well. Eric Holder in particular, you know, he crossed lots of ethical lines in my mind, and I had to actually step back and think to myself, but I'm a Republican looking through a Republican lens. Right. I don't like these people. I don't want to see them in all. I don't know them. You know, I can't say I don't like these people. I'd rather say I don't like them as politicians. I don't agree with their policy. I don't think they're doing the right thing for our country. And that's the lens that I'm viewing this through. And I, you know, I that's not lost on me. the fact that, you know, we all look through this with a different lens. You know, I try to be as unbiased as possible, but like you said, my, you know, capstone in grad school was about implicit bias. I mean, it's, everybody has implicit bias. It's there whether we try to filter it or not. And so looking at this case as a Republican, I think it goes without saying that I would like to see more proof before, because nobody wants to be wrong.
Sure. You know,
nobody wants to be wrong. If you turn out to be wrong or I turn out to be wrong, I just don't think that we're going to, that it's going to be that definitive in this case. And I would like to see more. I would. And I will go on the record saying I would like for this investigation to keep, or this pre-investigation to keep going and to figure out what's going on. I want to see what's, you know, if there was quid pro quo going on, I'd like to hear from more Trump officials. I'd like to hear about what was going on with the Bidens, because, you know, Biden sort of positioned himself as this, I guess, intermediary between the Obama administration and the Ukrainian government. And there was this history of corruption. So I would like to know what was going on. I'd like to know everything before I make a decision. And I just, I don't know. I don't know that we're going to get there in the next year and a half.
Yeah, well, it sounds like to me that what I'm hearing you saying is that while you acknowledge that there's not going to be a smoking gun, a tape where Donald Trump says they're going to do this, they're going to investigate Biden or they don't get the money. You know that's not going to happen, obviously. But
no.
But you're not saying that's the only thing that would convince you, but it would take a considerable more weight of the evidence. Maybe if, let's say, half a dozen more top State Department people who were in on these things testified that there was a quid pro quo, maybe that might possibly sway you. So your mind isn't totally made up, but you need a lot more than what you're hearing right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was the same with the Mueller investigation. I felt like, well, let's find out. You're making these big allegations. Let's find out the truth. But again, you know, it can't be overstated that I'm looking at this, you know, as a Republican. I don't want to be wrong. You know, I voted for President Trump. The thought of electing, you know, one of the people standing on the Democratic debate stage to be president just is, it's really, you know, it's to me, it's just a terrifying thought. But, you know,
I wanted to ask you about that because it just occurred to me that, you could make the argument that sort of the principled never Trump Republican stance would be to say, let's impeach and remove this corrupt man whose policies we like and replace him with Mike Pence, whose policies we like, who would not be nearly as corrupt because it would almost be impossible to be as corrupt. I mean, you can make, now obviously President Pence running for re-election with this little time and so forth, that would be a tough sell. And there's no way in hell that Donald Trump would campaign for him. But I mean, I could see that argument being kind of like, well, I like the policies, but I don't like the man. And more than that, I believe the man's corrupt. So I'm going to throw my support behind removing him and supporting Mike Pence for president. Well, what do you think about that?
I'm not a never Trumper. I have a handful of friends who are, you know, it's funny. It's hard for me to think. It's actually harder for me to put myself in the shoes of somebody like that than somebody who is a Democrat looking at this, because I think it's, and I know that sounds strange, and I guess I'm just realizing this now as I'm talking to you, but it's hard for me to imagine. It's hard for me to imagine a world where President Pence. See, I don't know. It's just it's a very strange scenario, but I do have a handful of never Trump or Republican friends. And as far as I can tell, they're also not in favor of a Pence presidency either, because now they've tied him to Trump. Because I've actually, I'm thinking of one friend of mine in particular who is, she's a conservative Catholic activist. And we disagree on a lot of things, but she's, you know, I guess at her core, she's conservative. We were both Bush supporters back in the day, and I guess that's, you know, where we can see eye to eye a little bit. But you know, I was talking to her about it and I said, so what, she's all for impeachment. And I asked her, this was a while ago, I asked her, so what's the end game? Is the end game a President Pence? It's the same question I've asked, you know, friends of mine who are Democrats. And I was surprised because I thought she would say, oh, yes, yes, President Pence, yay. But no, she said that he's too closely tied to Trump. He's part of it now. He's corrupt. He's this, he's that. I thought that was a really interesting take and not one I was expecting. I don't know.
Well, we certainly will be talking a lot more about this in the weeks to come. You know, I think maybe this would be a good time for us to move on. I know we were originally going to talk about, we were originally going to be talking about next the judge's ruling on the Harvard admissions case, but I was wondering if maybe we could stick with national politics and the Bidens and the race and all that kind of thing, and maybe talk a little bit about Bernie's heart, the 2020 Democrats. You know, you mentioned, of course, the fact that all of this impeachment stuff is really taking the focus off of a lot of other things, including, I would say, in a lot of ways, the Democratic race. And so, you know, would it be okay if we shifted to that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's actually a better transition, too, because as interesting as the Harvard admissions case is, this might be more in line with what we're discussing.
This is what I'm thinking. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I agree. So, OK, so let's talk about what's going on over on the left hand side of the aisle. So this was a big week in both good and bad ways for Democrats generally. And there were a few sort of stunning news stories that emerged. I was surprised by the Bernie thing. I don't know if you were, Mike, but I was surprised. On Tuesday, we found that out. Tuesday was a big news day, by the way. I realized that when I was writing these notes. A lot of things happened on Tuesday. We found out that the presidential candidate, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, was admitted to a hospital in Las Vegas after experiencing chest pains. And that was all the news we had on Tuesday. And his campaign quickly issued a statement in the news saying that he was being treated for a blockage in one artery, which I think made a lot of people go, hmm. But then on Friday, so this was just yesterday, Sanders' doctor released a statement that he'd had basically a heart attack, a myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack. It's the medical term for heart attack. Probably a mild one. That was kind of what people surmised. The procedures to place stents reportedly went well. Sanders was being released. He said he felt good. And his campaign also said he'd be taking part in the next Democratic debate, which is slated for, I think, October 15th, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to add, but, it's interesting because, and we'll talk about this, he came out on top with third quarter donation. You know, his third quarter earnings were on top. He was kind of having like the best quarter ever. And then this happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved his tweet afterwards. He said, none of us knows when a medical emergency might affect us, and no one should fear going bankrupt if it occurs. Medicare for all. It's a very Bernie kind of thing. But
he's always Bernie.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, here we have a 78-year-old guy, right? I mean, this has right. been... We've talked about it a lot more with Biden, who's 76. Of course, Elizabeth Warren's not young either. She's 70. Donald Trump
wasn't young either.
No, when he was sworn in, he was the oldest person to be sworn in as president for the first time. So this is a thing that obviously can happen. And if you take a look at, before we get to the fundraising, if you take a look at the polling numbers, I mean, what jumps out to me, aside from the fact that Biden is losing a lot of his big early lead, which has built a lot on name recognition, of course, is that, you know, Bernie had a pretty big name recognition lead. It was kind of Biden and Bernie, if we look back in May and June and so forth, and everyone else. And then kind of looking at the whole field, there was this sort of blip for Harris that's just totally gone away now. She's fallen back into the pack. And aside from that, the one clear thing has been Elizabeth Warren just steadily moving up to the point now where she's just about even with Joe Biden, slightly below that. And so you add that up with now this news about Bernie and the fact that Warren and Sanders are both sort of fighting for that progressive side of the party. It seems to me that this has kind of helped to move Warren in a position where I wouldn't call her the presumptive favorite. But if you look at the prediction markets, I pulled them up just before we started to go on. Right now, she's at a share for Warren is 52 cents and a share for Biden is 21. He's the second. So the markets certainly seem to think that she is the clear favorite. The trend sure makes her look like the clear favorite, or not the clear favorite, but sure looks positive for her more than anyone else. And clearly it's not Warren's race to lose at this point, but if I were in any of these candidates' position, I think right now I'd want to be Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, I actually pulled up the numbers because I didn't know all the numbers. I knew that she had done well. So, you know, Sanders was the clear front runner in terms of earnings, third quarter earnings at 25.3 million, but she wasn't far behind with 24.6 million. Yep. So she was just a little, you know, hop, skip and a jump down. And then followed by, I thought I would see Biden, but it was Buttigieg with 19.1 million. He's become a bit of a darling with the heavyweight donors on the Democratic side. I figured you'd enjoy hearing that.
Yeah, well, and then, you know, it's weird because, you know, I saw that too with Biden in fourth, and I thought, well, hey, if Biden falters, Buttigieg is sort of probably in the best position to kind of take that up and run sort of a little bit to the right of Warren and Sanders. But of course, if Bernie keeps on faltering, basically, you can see a scenario in which this becomes a two-person race. And I think this is probably what Buttigieg is hoping, is that Biden continues to falter and there are all these questions circling around. And all of a sudden, some of the money that was going to Biden, the kind of more centrist money, drifts a little bit and support drifts to Buttigieg. But his problem has been not so much getting the money, but his support has kind of stayed clearly second tier. He hasn't been able to move up a whole lot in the polls. And my guess would be this next debate that happens on October 15th, there are 12 people on the stage. Totally ridiculous, right? Not a debate. But after that, we're going to start to see the great winnowing. And if I'm the Buttigieg campaign, I'm thinking, okay, once we clear out all the deadwood after, you know, this October 15th debate, then we're maybe set up to make a run for moving up into the top tier in the debate that follows after that, I would think. So that would be my guess as to their strategy there. And certainly they have enough money to be buying the ads and trying to position themselves.
Right. And I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's also a Republican. And we were saying, well, if we were thinking like Democrats and we were approaching the next debate with the 900 people that are going to be up on stage, I think those big debates on either side are just, it's just like almost too much to pay attention to, honestly. Mm-hmm. But, if you're the Buttigieg campaign, for example, you're looking at Joe Biden because he shares in a lot of those policy issues, things like that. What it's really going to come down to is personality, because at this point, Biden's history, especially with all the questions, you know, that have come about with the Ukraine and his son, and there are other things too that have come into play. He's always been particularly prone to gaffes, you know, the corn pop, you know, all these things have sort of come up in the last few months. He's prone to this. Buttigieg is not necessarily prone to this. He's pretty sharp. I actually thought he would do better at the debates than he has. And I watched the debates with a lot of interest, mainly for him. He's a political newcomer. I know nothing about him. And as a Republican, I'm like, ooh, should I be afraid of this guy? I thought he would do better. I had kind of hoped he would do better just from a democracy standpoint, you know, give these people a run for their money. And he didn't. And then, you know, when it comes to Sanders and Warren, with the two of them being so close in terms of support and fundraising, the Sanders thing just could not have come at a worse time for him. Again, if I'm thinking like a Democrat who supports Sanders, but a lot of their policies are relatively indistinguishable from one another. So again, it comes down to personality. And ultimately, they are going to be facing, you know, President Trump, who is, you know, has a cult of personality all his own. And he raised a staggering amount of money with the RNC, $125 million in the third quarter, because he's been using all of this talk about impeachment and everything. He's been using it to his advantage. Yep. And it's scaring Republicans, you know. So I think whereas the Democratic candidates have been eclipsed by a lot of this impeachment, you know, all of these proceedings, they've lost some steam in the media. Some of them have managed to sort of twist and turn it. Really nobody better than Bernie Sanders. That's what he's good at, messaging. And, you know, he knows his base. He knows he gets a lot of small donations from a lot of supporters. The same thing happened in 2016. And so he's been able to leverage the impeachment just like Donald Trump has, conversely. So I think maybe if like Warren, Buttigieg, maybe Biden should stay out of it. But, you know, maybe if Warren, Buttigieg, and maybe the others were able to do that in a meaningful way, they'd be able to raise more money. Yeah. I mean, after Biden, it's, you know, Harris at 11.6 million is the next. So there's a pretty big divide.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you know, some people have been making note of Andrew Yang, kind of, he's slowly rising, but not
that's
by
nothing yet, to shake a stick no. at, you know.
But I think that Andrew Yang is not going to be the nominee. I feel fairly confident about that. But, you know, you mentioned the Donald Trump and the RNC. And of course, once there is a Democratic nominee, money's going to pour into nominees.
Yeah.
But another point to make is, if you take a look at the last couple of presidential elections, I mean, it's pretty clear that money, essentially, the analogy I like to make all the time is it's kind of like oxygen. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient to win an election. In 2016, right, Donald Trump's campaign raised $247 million, to Hillary Clinton raising almost $500 million.
Yeah.
And obviously, we know the result of that. Even back in 2012, though, Romney's campaign raised $446 million, Obama's $715 million. But overall, considering outside money, Mitt Romney actually, Romney money was a little higher, like $1.24 billion versus $1.12 billion. And so the candidate with the most money doesn't necessarily win. There's a lot of other things going on there, but certainly if you can't raise that money, you're not going to be a serious contender. And Donald Trump, of course, and this is kind of odd because he gets so much free publicity, and not only that, but money is more important to people who aren't as well known to get their names out there. Whereas if you're Donald Trump, I mean, pretty much it's hard to believe that there are people who are saying, Donald who? And I don't know how I feel about Donald Trump. You know, that's kind of difficult to imagine that sort of thing, I think.
Yeah, but I think it's funny. I was with my kids the other day, and my youngest said to me, who's the most famous person in the world? And I thought, oh, that's a really interesting question. It's such a kid question, you know, but I started thinking about it. And he was like, I think it's Donald Trump. And this is a kid who he doesn't know politics from, you know, anything else in his life. And it, certainly, you know, we talk about it a lot at home, but I make a concerted effort not to sway my children in any direction. They're young. They don't understand. They'll make up their minds, you know, when they get older. And I just thought that was really interesting. And I asked him why. I said, you know, why do you think it's Donald Trump? I may agree with you, but, you know, why do you think it's Donald Trump? And he was like, it's just everything is always all about Donald Trump. And he's right. So he gets all this free publicity. There's a tremendous amount of energy on, you know, behind him in his campaign. And he has a tremendous amount of energy, for better or worse. I mean, you know, he's good, bad, however you feel about him. That's where the energy is. There's still that fire there. And so, you know, you would have to be on the left, you know, again, thinking like a Democratic strategist, you would want a candidate who was able to capture that sort of energy. I mean, it wasn't Hillary Clinton in 2016. Yeah. And I think that was a fatal flaw in her campaign, was she just couldn't capture that kind of enthusiasm. Sanders may have been able to do it in 2016, which is why I've told you that, you know, I feared at one point his campaign a lot, because there was a tremendous amount of energy behind him. But, you know, with this health scare, like we discussed, you know, it sort of hangs in the balance. Will Warren or Biden be able to capture that kind of energy? I don't know.
Yeah. And Warren always struck me as kind of a much wonkier Sanders, with less sort of that personal magnetism. So she has a plan for everything. And a lot of people on the left are obviously enthusiastic about her. But it's not the same sort of visceral enthusiasm that I think I felt and still feel a lot of people have for Bernie, you know, and it's a very different kind of thing. So, you know, it's interesting, because when you look at the presidential election prediction markets, the number one person still is Donald Trump. A share of Donald Trump is 41 cents, Elizabeth Warren 35, and then Joe Biden at 14 cents. So at least the people who are putting their money where their prediction is still think that Donald Trump has a slight edge to win re-election. And I think that's something, it's easy for those of us on the left to think, well, my God, after everything that's happened, and the fact that demographic changes favor the Democrats, and the fact that how can you possibly have seen the last X years, number of years, and not want to just run this guy out of town on a rail? How is it even possible that he could win a second term? But, you know, it's entirely possible, which is why it's important to keep that in mind. You know, incumbent presidents in recent history have done very well, especially when the economy's doing well. And, you know, the jobs report came out, unemployment's at a 50-year low. And so all these things weigh into it. And it's important for us to step out of our hyper political inside the beltway sort of bubbles and look around and see all the Trump Pence bumper stickers and all that enthusiasm on that end of things. So I can envision a world very easily, to my great dismay, that has Donald Trump with another term in office. And that scares the heck out of me, I got to say.
No, I understand where you're coming from. I feel the same. Again, it's you know, the flip side of the coin. I feel the same way when I think about like a President Sanders or a President Biden or a President Warren. The thought of that scares me so much. You know, the things that they're saying make no sense to somebody who's a fiscal. I consider myself a pretty strong fiscal conservative in particular. And I think to myself, oh, my gosh, you know, what they're saying makes no sense. How can it make sense to anybody? And I'm not saying, you know, we're so quick to point fingers and call each other names. And I don't think it's because anyone's stupid or smart or not as smart. We just have different world views. Sure. And so I'm looking at this and I'm saying, oh, how could you see this as a good thing? How could you see this as not a threat, you know, to our society, especially in our economy, which is doing so well.
Yeah.
But again, I have to step out of that. And I have to say, you know, it's I don't agree with what you're saying. I totally get it. Because I've been in that position. I was in that position with President Obama. I saw things happening left and right and thought, oh man, how come people don't see what I'm seeing? But it's that worldview and that biased perspective that forces us into these camps and separates us further.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and the dream scenario on the left is pretty clearly where Sanders or Warren gets elected and there's sort of a blue wave that not only the Democrats keep their House majority, but they win a Senate majority. And then the first thing the new Democratic majority does is they get rid of the filibuster. And all of a sudden now the decks are cleared for all kinds of what I would see as largely awesome things, but that would just make you just cringe, essentially.
Shaking my boots, yes.
it would be exactly like how, you know, for me, the only thing that's prevented the country from just descending into just utter awfulness is the fact that there was enough of a congressional check on this president's awful policies. And my great lament, obviously, is there's been no check on the judicial nominations, which is a huge issue. And it would be the same thing just in reverse for you, obviously. And
it would be
one thing I did want to mention that, you know, you talked about how Biden with all these allegations and things like that. And I could hear a lot of Biden folks saying, and I kind of count myself in that camp because I think that he would probably make the most effective president of all of the candidates, just because I think his understanding of the process and his understanding of what's realistic, what's doable, and what isn't is much better than anyone else in the field, with maybe the exception of someone like a Cory Booker, who's not gonna be the nominee to my disappointment, but. You know, that idea that they have these allegations, yeah, sure, they're unfounded and they seem to be just completely spurious, I would say, and I would agree, but it doesn't matter because once they're out there, I mean, if nothing else, the Trump administration has demonstrated to me that if you lie often enough and loud enough, enough people are going to say, well, I don't know, I heard, and, you know, a big lie repeated often enough at least puts doubt into people's minds, and that's where we are with Joe Biden, and so that's why I think that his chances of being the nominee are a lot less now than they were a couple of weeks ago, even though I don't think he's done anything wrong. You know, in fact, just the opposite. But that, in the world of politics, that doesn't necessarily matter.
Well, just to take off of what you said, where the world of politics, it doesn't matter. I agree. And I think that, I've worked on several campaigns, and campaigns are all about optics. And I mentioned this before with impeachment. I do believe that, and I've said it before, Pelosi is somebody who understands optics very well, and she understands strategy very well, which is why I think a lot of Republicans were surprised when she moved forward with all of this, with this inquiry, this pre-inquiry, because she seemed to be staving it off for as long as she could, which was smart, I think. But she ultimately decided to move forward with it. I think probably she was getting internal pressure from, the more left-leaning members of the Democratic Party in the House. But I think probably, one of the more interesting things is that this is all about optics. And so, again, if you can tie impeachment, the word impeachment, even though people don't know really what it means sometimes, or, it's such an inscrutable concept for most people to understand. I even had to research it, and I felt like I did understand, but I didn't, So if you can tie those two together, it creates this extremely negative optic. I think that's what they're thinking. I think that's the strategy. Yeah. And I think that's probably what she's thinking. And I think it's the same thing on the right, because for a long time, and I'm the first one to admit that Democrats have had their optics game together. I mean, they've done such a good job of managing optics within campaigns and messaging and stuff like that. The Obama campaign was masterful at doing that, and they did a wonderful job. He was fabulous on the campaign trail. But Donald Trump's campaign team is sort of taking a page from this Democratic optics messaging, manual, and applying it with the whole Biden, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, Ukraine thing. And I absolutely think that in turn, that's what they're doing. And I think that's why we're seeing huge fundraising numbers in the third quarter for him, because they've been able to do it. So if I was a Democrat, I'd be nervous about that, because that's not looking good. And, whether or not is Biden expendable? That's been a big debate this week. Is he expendable? And for someone like you, who sees him as the most logical choice, or the person who could possibly, become the nominee and has the experience to actually do the job, that would be really frightening for me if I was to think that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know we're running kind of long, but I thought we could end on sort of a prediction. Jay has been saying for a long time now that he thinks that the House will vote to impeach the president. And I will say right now that, given what I've heard, I have come over to Jay's perspective on this, and I agree that the House will, and I think should, vote to impeach Donald Trump. And I believe then, when it goes over for a trial in the Senate, which Mitch McConnell said he would in fact hold, he wouldn't try to defer it or anything like that, I believe that there will be a motion to dismiss that, which the Republicans, certainly can offer. And that motion will not get a majority in the Senate. There will be at least one, maybe two, might get a slight majority. I think there'll be at least one or two Republicans who will vote to not just outright dismiss that motion, which is different, obviously, from voting to convict and remove the president. But I think, like a Romney or a Collins, when it comes down to a vote, are going to say, no, I think we should actually have the trial. But if it actually came to a trial, I don't know they'd actually vote to convict and remove. But that's how I think it's all going to end. I think it's going to end with a successful Republican motion to dismiss the charges against Donald Trump in the Senate, which at least I predict one or maybe two Republicans will vote against, but there'll still be enough votes for that to carry. That's my prediction. How do you see this playing out, Kristen? I know it's kind of just totally speculative, but what the heck?
I actually see it playing out pretty similarly. I'm not as sure that it's going that the idea of impeachment is going to move through the House as easily as you are, but I predict that it will probably happen. I'm not, you know, I'm not willing to obviously like put sign my name to it or anything like that.
Sure.
Because I do think you have a lot of red state Democrats who are waffling. I've heard a lot of, especially like in local papers, which I love reading local papers and I don't do it enough. I wish I did more of it, but I've been doing it because I wanted to see what these sort of big name red state Democrats were saying, and they're hesitant. And I understand why, you know, even though we may agree with it or we may not agree with it, they're looking at possibly being, you know, being voted out very soon. So, you know, I don't think it's a surefire thing. I think it'll probably move through the House because I think there's enough energy behind it and enough disdain for Donald Trump. You know, I think a lot of them were prepared to impeach him before any of this even began. I think they would have voted.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, I think it'll move through in the Senate. I think it'll be stymied. I think it will stop. I think there'll be a successful motion to dismiss as well. And, you know, most of the Republicans and Democrats I know who, you know, are aware of what's going on sort of feel this way. So I don't think it's like a, you know, a terribly controversial view. But again, I think this is about optics.
Yeah,
so.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we ran a little bit
no,
long,
okay.
But we have more
stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And we have more to talk about. In fact, on the special supporters after show bonus show, I think this week we are going to be talking about, well, we didn't get to the FCC's net neutrality ruling, which is, mm-hmm. I think, or sorry, the federal court's ruling on that. And I think that's kind of an important story that we could talk about maybe a little bit on the bonus show, along with a really kind of interesting story about how California has passed this law that would allow college athletes to benefit from endorsement deals. And now there's actually a proposal potentially in Congress to make that national. And that should be a lot of fun to talk about, I think. So we will be doing that in the bonus show, folks. If you are a supporter, that should be in your podcast feed by the time you hear this. And if you're not a supporter and you'd like to hear it, as well as, by the way, the quick take this week, which Will has put together for you, well, just go to politicsguys.com/support. And sign up. And of course, if you want to get in touch with us, mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page, facebook.com/politicsguys page. And we're also on Twitter @politicsguys. If you haven't subscribed to the show yet, it would really help us out. We would appreciate it. As well as if you can let people know about the show, word of mouth is always really great advertising for us. All right. The executive producers of the Politics Guys, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, and Daniel Toe. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski and Kristen Matheny. We will be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.